Hear from best-selling author Jonah Sacks on his book, Unsafe Thinking.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for coming out. This is an exciting day for me. My book launches tomorrow, and this is the first time I'm giving a talk about something I've been working on for the last 2.5 years. Yeah, I'll remember you, and hopefully you'll remember me. So let's get started just asking you guys to get uncomfortable for a second. I want you to bring to mind that problem in your career or in your business that you know you need to take action on. But for whatever reason, so far, you still haven't fully embraced it and fully taken it on. I'm going to talk about the reason for that in a moment, actually, that you haven't. But for the moment, just bring it to mind. So we live in this world, and we're trying to create in a world of incredible, rapid change. And change is really hard for individuals and for organizations. As human beings, we're programmed by evolution to prefer patterns, to prefer thinking in ways that we thought yesterday, to prefer behaving in ways that made sense yesterday, and to prefer especially problem solving in the ways that we always have. But in rapidly changing environments, that type of thinking no longer works. And we get ourselves into situations where problems that are key and existential to our businesses and our careers go unsolved because our thinking can't evolve with the pace of change around us. So I want to tell you two stories to get us started before I jump in and give you some tools for breaking out of this kind of safe thinking. The first is the story of someone who was an unsafe thinker. That's me. For 17 years, I was an entrepreneur who ran a creative agency. I founded that agency in 1999 because I wanted to explore how social change could be created on the new tools of communication that were giving everybody a chance to take action, to share the messages they most cared about. We were exploring an exciting new landscape. And the tool that we most landed on was a storytelling tool. We created these short, weird animations years before YouTube was ever invented that got people to think about the issues they cared most about, environmentalism, human rights, social justice, and then take action. These videos would reach 1,000 people and then millions of people and eventually tens of millions of people, and these experiments were really working. But in those successes, the seeds of my own failure were being planted because what was happening was I was being asked to get on stages like this one and tell people how it was done. I was being anointed as an expert. And by becoming an expert, I started to have a lot more answers than I had questions. I started having methodologies that I would bring back to my growing company to make it more predictable and rules for how to be creative. And though the company was growing, I realized that what we were doing was far less creative, and the world of social media and marketing was changing around us, and we were standing still selling the same old thing that was still working, but not working like it really needed to. Problem was, though I knew I needed to change my thinking, I also was completely reliant for the 40 people who worked for me by sticking with the thinking that had always worked and the methods that had always worked. I knew I was in a trap, but I didn't know how to get out. So what I did is I went out and I spoke to more than 100 people and read decades of science. I spoke to people who I saw change themselves and change their companies to really break through and keep up with a rapidly evolving world. And so I'm going to share some of their stories today and the lessons I've learned. Now, let's look at somebody quite different than me, someone I would call an unsafe thinker, one of my favorite stories of the people that I encountered along the way. This is Helena Foulkes. And Foulkes was the vice president at CVS at a time when the company was working really hard to define its core purpose. And the purpose they came up with, like all companies, was pretty bland, right? It was to deliver health and wellness to people. No big deal. The problem was that Foulkes was a cancer survivor. And she saw that there was this huge hypocrisy in CVS's core purpose because they were selling $2 billion a year of tobacco products at the front of their stores that were supposed to be delivering health and wellness to communities across America. Now, she would go up on stage and talk about the core purpose, and some part of her inside felt terrible, kind of like I felt, like sharing an idea that I knew wasn't quite right. She quickly found that there were others within the organization who also thought this was crazy, but who takes $2 billion worth of sales off of your books? Everyone thought that would be impossible and knew that even talking about it would be to question the top leadership and to question business as usual in a way that made people very uncomfortable. Foulkes knew that she couldn't change anybody's mind just by appealing to their hearts. As much as we like to think that a core purpose can drive an organization, it can't when you're talking about $2 billion worth of sales. She knew she couldn't change them at the heart level, so she needed to get to their head level. She asked herself a simple question. What if we could make more money by not selling cigarettes? And this led to all kinds of fairly obvious but overlooked information. Thanks to a changing healthcare market, customers would be spending a lot more their prescriptions than on retail. And the new kind of partnerships that she could make with the government and with nonprofits, she thought could deliver far more than it would cost. So she slowly built up this head in this heart approach and an unsafe idea that challenged her bosses. Eventually, she got the green light and CVS took tobacco products out of their stores. In the first year, though they gave up $2 billion, they made $11 billion additional money from this incredible move. And again, there was nothing ingenious about it. It was just a willingness to break the spell of conformity and authority within the company. I wanted to know how I could go from this to this more effectively. And I'm glad to say that I made that journey. And I think the things and the principles that I learned that I'm going to share with you today will allow anybody to make the journey, whether it's for yourself or for the teams that you lead. And some of these principles you may already be living, while others are extremely counterintuitive. I found that these counterintuitive insights came up again and again, and that's partly because intuition is actually often cultural, conventional wisdom dressed up as our own thinking. We hear it so many times, we just know it must be right, when in fact, it's what other people are telling us and not coming from our true intuitive voices. So some of this stuff might sound weird, some of the stuff you may already be living, but I'm going to share with you five key tips today and five principles that make people unsafe thinkers based on decades of science and, again, more than 100 conversations with innovators like Helena Folks. So the first thinking trap I want to talk about is the overarching one, the big theme of this book and my new thinking, which is the safe thinking, the problem of safe thinking. This is a biological response to threat. Sometimes entrepreneurs don't have this response as deeply as your average person, but the teams they lead nearly always do. And it goes something like this. Imagine you have just put together a new product. You've spent a lot of time and money and social capital, leadership capital building this product. And before taking it out to the world, you of course want to test it. So you put it out to a couple hundred users. You're all excited to get the feedback. And the feedback comes back that the product sucks. People hated it. What are you going to do? How do you address such a problem when you know you need to go, you need to move forward with the product you created? Well, this leads to the beginning of a cycle. The cycle begins with threat awareness. And in the business environments we now work, threat awareness is unavoidable. It may happen because you get negative feedback about something you've created. It may happen because your boss tells you you need to meet higher sales targets. It may happen because you're so successful that you're standing up on stages that were bigger than the stages you were on before and the competition is better. To do anything in business today is to experience threat awareness, and we have an automatic response to threat awareness. It's called anxiety, of course. We sense that our work, our well-being, is somehow threatened by a challenge we face. And anxiety leads automatically to something called cortical arousal. This is a neurological phenomenon, something that happens in the brain that is actually quite positive. Cortical arousal gives us adrenaline. It gives us cortisol. It gives us that get off your ass and do something kind of feeling that makes us act. Without cortical arousal, we would just sit and never create businesses or entrepreneurial ventures at all. But cortical arousal also has a dark side. The dark side of cortical arousal comes from our evolutionary history. See, what our ancestors faced when they faced anxiety was usually a threat to their lives. And what they needed at those times was not more creativity. When you face a lion, you don't need to widen your options. You just need to act right now. So cortical arousal has been shown through so many scientific experiments, both looking at the brain and watching innovators in action. Too much cortical arousal leads to stereotypical thinking. We're going to do something right now. We're going to do what worked for those guys over there. We're going to do what worked in my old job 10 years ago. And we literally cannot think in new ways. Though we may sense it's time to open up, our brains are shouting at us to close down. In rapidly changing worlds, this kind of safe thinking, though it works really well to temporarily allay anxiety, is extremely dangerous. It leads companies to fail to act again and again. So in this scenario that I just laid out, you have a choice. Are you going to act deeply on this negative feedback? And this may not be the scenario you exactly face, but are you going to act deeply in the face of this threat, or are you going to act quickly? There's going to be two impulses. As a leader of a venture, you know the right thing to do is to act deeply. But the more primal, more automatic response is to do something to address the problem right away and close it down. It's this kind of response that led Blockbuster to have meeting after meeting when they knew streaming video was coming to eat their lunch and they had to do something about it, but to walk out of those meetings saying, we're doing enough with the incremental changes that we're making to our business model. It's the same impulse that allowed Nokia engineers to laugh at the flip phone and then laugh at the smartphone, convinced that continuing with their model would always make customers happiest, because it got them past that automatic fear cycle and caused them to act quickly in ways that made short-term solutions, but never to act deeply to make real change. So we have this sense that some people, some innovators, just naturally don't feel this fear. And I wanted to ask the innovators I talked to, how do you not feel this anxiety in the face of change? And what they told me universally is, I feel a ton of anxiety in the face of change. And one of them pointed me to the story of Magandhi, which I didn't know the whole thing of course, I know who he is, but I didn't know his whole story. And one amazing thing about Gandhi, he's probably the most courageous, unsafe thinker in the history of modern times, did amazing and innovative things. But as a young man, as a young lawyer, he was so terrified of any kind of social interaction that he couldn't speak in front of a crowd. As a lawyer, he once got up in small claims court on a $10 case and couldn't utter a single word. And every time he embarrassed himself, he would run away. So eventually he ran to South Africa where no one knew him and no one would laugh at him. And there, he also kept himself in the back office of a law firm trying to take on the smallest cases he possibly could. And then one night he experienced what he called the most creative incident of his life, which he's riding on a train across South Africa, high in the mountains, when someone complained about a little brown man sitting in a white man's seat. They kicked him off the train without his luggage. He lay freezing on a platform. And he realized in that moment, he wrote in his autobiography, that every time he recoiled and retracted from something that made him nervous, the smaller and smaller his life became, and the more fear he would feel the next day. And he promised himself that now he would move towards those things that he was most afraid of. And he said this was the foundation for the entire career that he would then build and every decision he would make. And this is the way that's been studied, but not well reported, out of that safe thinking cycle. So we can't help but feeling threat awareness. In fact, we should be feeling more threat awareness if we're aware of what's really happening around us. And if we're reaching new levels of success, if we're keeping our eyes open, threat awareness is inevitable. We can't stop feeling anxiety, and we shouldn't deny it inside, because any attempt to get rid of a negative feeling has been shown time and again to only make that feeling worse. Instead, we need to reframe that fear. Now, if you naturally do this, great. But it's also time to teach our team members to do it as well and to create companies that live by this standard. If we think of fear as fuel for creativity, if we remind the people that work with us and for us that nothing great has ever happened without making people who are doing it uncomfortable, and unless we're regularly taking the kind of risks that could lead to loss of reputation or failure, we're probably playing too safe. We can break out of that automatic response to anxiety. And again, it happens at all levels of the company, both for leaders and for people who are first joining in. And the best, most innovative companies continually ask themselves questions like these. When we get feedback that something's not working, not what's the quickest route to solving this, but what's a compelling course of action that actually scares us? How deeply can we address this problem? How truly can we look at what our critics are saying or what our users are saying and address it at the deepest possible level? And what might we do that we've never done before? These three questions, when we face threat and change, can change how we approach the anxiety of the world changing around us. And they've been incredibly helpful for me in changing the business model of the companies that I've led. Okay, so the second trap is what I spoke about a little bit at the beginning of this talk, which is expert blindness. So I don't know if you've ever had this dream, but you walk into a classroom, turn over a paper, there's a test on it that you didn't expect. The questions are incredibly difficult. And then as you read on, they're written in a language you don't speak. And then you go a little further and they're written in some sort of pictographic scribbles. And you're like, what the hell is going on here? I can't possibly answer these questions. And then you realize you haven't been to class in 6 months. And then you realize you didn't even sign up for this class, but you're going to fail if you don't pass this exam. And then you wake up. This is one of the most common dreams across all cultures and all societies that's been studied. And dream experts say that we have this dream to remind us how important it is to know our stuff, to not put ourselves in situations where we're beginners, and to be experts. We wake up from these dreams, at least I do, feeling a sense of sweet relief that, oh, I finished high school a long time ago, I passed, I actually know a lot about my field. Illustration of how stepping into a situation with expertise makes us feel comfortable and safe, and how ignorance can be terrifying. But there's a problem with too much expertise. The problem is called entrenchment. And entrenchment cuts across all industries and all fields. It works like this. If we want to be an original thinker, we need to understand our field pretty well. It's almost impossible to create. It's a total beginner, right? A lot of entrepreneurs actually do try to do this. They kind of eschew knowing anything about their space. They come in as major disruptors, and many of them fail because they haven't taken the time to learn what's worked before. They haven't taken the time to deeply apprentice themselves and learn. But as we get to a certain point on this inverted U, we reach what's called entrenchment. So we get these vast knowledge networks as we become better learners. And you should, with bigger knowledge networks, technically have more trouble recalling things because you've got so many things in your brain. But the way memory works and logic concepts work is that we store them in neat catalogs. We take every new thing we learn and we put it into a structure that fits. It's like a card catalog at a library. Anything we see with a strong knowledge network, we're like, oh, that's just a new flavor of an old problem. And we know what to do with it. And that's what leads to this trap of entrenchment in which we see the world in a blind way. Philip Tetlock, a researcher, an expert on experts, did an amazing study. He asked 200 experts to make predictions about the future. He did it over 20 years. He collected these 20,000 different predictions and then judged it against reality. You know how they did? They did worse than random chance. Literally, if you had taken dart-throwing monkeys that were blindfolded and threw them at the wall, you would have done better than these experts. And the experts that did the worst were the ones that were most often quoted on television and in newspapers, the ones who had an ego attachment to the knowledge networks that they had built. They literally could not see the world as it was because they spent so much time defending what they knew and building their sense of self around it. Now, Tetlock broke these experts up into hedgehogs and foxes. Hedgehogs were those who knew one thing and a huge amount about that one thing, and foxes performed a little bit better. They knew about a lot of things, but a little bit about each of those. So they did better than the hedgehogs. But even they, the more that they got esteem and made money off their expertise, the more foolish they became in making predictions. So a question, a simple thing that I ask anybody who's reaching a certain level of status in their career is, how are you spending your time? Are you staying in your lane, or do you spend a significant amount of time doing things that you actually suck at? Now, why does this matter? We live in a very specialized world where there's not a lot of time and we have to do what we're best at in order to create value. But the more we spend our time in that box while the world changes around us, the less flexible our thinking becomes. Creativity studies show that people who have lived just 6 months abroad perform much better on all measures of creativity than people who never have. Why? Well, when you go abroad, you're absolutely a beginner again. You suck at the new culture because you don't know how to fit the new information into your old knowledge networks. And so your knowledge networks start to break down. You also become, your ego starts to collapse a little bit because you're not an expert on the place that you're in. Like I said before, those foxes of Tetlock's who didn't spend their time picking away at one idea and going deeper and deeper into it were able to break that trap of expertise. So when we do things that break down our ego and that teach us new things, we start to learn more quickly, and we bring analogies from that new world that we're stepping into our own world, which breaks up new possibilities for creativity. So one of my favorite stories and the favorite innovators that I came across in this search is this guy, Vineet Nayar. And he took over this company, HCL Technologies, while the company was an IT outsourcing company. And it was facing rapid and enormous threats, 55,000 person company. He came in and he realized he had no idea what to do to fix this problem of all these other players entering the market. And he had to address 5,000 of his leaders as his first act as CEO. What he did was he got up on stage, he had his PowerPoint presentation ready to go, but one thing he was terrible at, he knew, was dancing. He's always been a terrible dancer. And so, as he got up on stage, he had them play an awful Bollywood tune. I watched this video. It is not pretty. He kind of gets down into the stands, and it's embarrassing at first. He's kind of wiggling and waggling, and everyone, especially in the culture of this company, which was very kind of emperor-based, starts tittering and laughing. And then soon, the whole crowd is dancing with him. They're all dancing around him and laughing. They sit back down. He's sweaty, kind of looks like a mess, and then he starts to give his presentation. Now, when Nayar looks back on this, he said that, yes, he was trying to be that humble leader who was coming off his podium so that people would trust him more, but more he was playing a trick on himself. He didn't want to be in that place where he thought for 1 minute he had to defend some kind of infallible sense of expertise. That by saying, I want to talk to you and hear from you and get ideas from my employees, and doing something that humiliated himself, he was able to let go of that sense that he had to know and could become a student again. And that's an extreme example of doing something that you suck at, but we can do this in so many ways by spending just a few minutes or a few hours a week really outside of our zones of expertise and making sure that we cherish and give credence to what we know, but never attach our sense of self to the knowledge that we've created. So I sum this up by saying, aim to be an explorer and not an expert. It should be part of your leadership brand to not have the answers and to not know, but to be someone who is passionate about gaining new knowledge. And again, people who are passionate about gaining new knowledge see the world clearly for what it is. And as the world changes more and more quickly, seeing it clearly becomes the most important skill that we can have. So push yourself to have more questions than answers. Spend significant time outside of your domain of expertise. And as a leader, err on the side of humility. This was really a hard one for me because having started a company at 24 years old, I was always trying to pretend to be something more than I was. It felt like I had to have a sense of being better than such a young person running a business, and felt that no one would follow me if I didn't try to push myself higher than I really felt where I was at. Amazingly, leadership studies show that people far prefer to follow humble leaders than they do to follow self-aggrandizing or confident leaders. So of your leadership brand, people will not just, you won't just be playing that trick on yourself, but people will be more willing to follow you knowing you don't have the answers if you project openness and humility. So aim to be an explorer rather than an expert. Okay, so the third lesson, this one was really difficult for me to take in because as a creative, I have always been a gut instinct guy. But the question of how we deal with our gut instincts is of critical importance, and most of us never think about it. We, as entrepreneurs, need to be excellent pattern matchers. We need to be able to take a look at a chaotic world and see patterns that no one else is able to see. But how do you do that? Do you rely on just a deep sense of knowing your gut instinct? Or do you rely on facts and data and analysis? Or are you not sure? Do you never really think about this? Well, some people, though we all have intuition, some people are fanatical about listening to their intuition. I'll talk about some of those people in a moment. They'll do anything to follow their guts. And other people have learned to sort of tamp their guts down, to not listen to it, to be so data-driven that they only make decisions that are rational and can be justified by the facts on the ground. Both of these are terrible mistakes, but the science of how to actually make your gut instinct better and know when to use it and when not is locked up in all of these very, very difficult to read and access journals in the far reaches of psychological sciences on the science of intuition. So I found it hard to find the answers to these questions, but very compelling. So let me give you guys a scenario. So take the statement, give a man a fish, feed him for a day, teach a man to fish, feed him for a lifetime. I'm sure you've heard this before. Or the best way to help the world's poorest people is simply to give them cash, no questions asked. So which would you choose? And how did you come to a decision about which you would choose? Was it analysis? Did you pull out your phones and do some research? Or was it gut instinct? Would you even need to analyze a question like this? Most of us don't. Nearly everybody chooses this first idea, and nearly everybody uses intuition to do it. And that pervaded an entire multi-billion-dollar aid industry for decades. But a couple of Harvard economists thought that maybe everyone was wrong about this. And they thought so because they saw there was a cultural bias behind this statement. You guys can tell what it is? Think about the cultural bias. Is that poor people don't know what to do with the money that we give them, right? And in some ways, in the developed world, that bias comes from some amount of experience. In the developed world, the poorest people are on the outskirts of society. They may often suffer from trauma, from PTSD, from substance abuse, mental health issues. And so if we give them money, it might make the situation worse. But in places where people are living on a dollar a day or less, being poor is just part of being born there. And these people may be very much part of the mainstream of society. So these guys decided, let's test this broken cultural intuition about what the right way to do aid is. And again, tens of billions of dollars a year are being invested based on this cultural truism. So they started giving people $1,000, no questions asked, $1,000 to people who were making a dollar a day through their cell phones. In Kenya, someone would just open their phone and suddenly there's $1,000 in their account, and they didn't even ask them to get back to them with any kind of promise that they would do anything special with the money. Everyone told them that these people would spend their money on alcohol or gambling. The folks at Google.org told them they were smoking crack. They tested it out, and they got amazing results. More than 97% of the money was being spent on things like fixing a roof, going to school, starting a business, much-needed health care. And they started publishing papers about it. Within a couple years, they had raised more than $35 million to give away $1,000 at a time. And this money doesn't go to corrupt officials or to program officers. It goes right to people whose lives are being forever changed because they were willing to question some basic cultural intuition that wasn't based on anything except bias. So here's the problem. Gut instinct is in many ways what makes us brilliant. Our brains process about 20% in the conscious realm of what we take in and see. 80% goes deep inside of us where we can't see what's happening with that information, but we have it. And our brains are working on it, pattern matching with it, coming up with insights. And when it does, we get these insights in a flash of inspiration. We just know. Now, this is great when the rules of the game don't change and we've been playing the game many times. We do have good intuitions. But an interesting study of bridge players showed that when the rules changed, those who relied on intuition struggled to keep up with rule changes, and those who relied on analysis were able to actually keep up with those changes as they came. So do leaders really rely on intuition, or is it just those of us who are standing on the outside? Surveys of business leaders, when they've been asked, do you rely on data, the opinion of others, or intuition? Top business executives consistently say they rely on intuition. In Silicon Valley, large studies of venture capitalists have shown that intuition trumps business model, it trumps market analysis. They meet the entrepreneur and they say they just know. They just know. And that's why they're paid so much, because only they have this brilliant intuition. Well, these Silicon Valley investors have also been making a tremendous mistake over the last 10 years. Over the last 10 years, they've given men 34 times as much money as they've given female entrepreneurs, based on gut instinct. They look at these entrepreneurs and they just know that this woman is not going to create a valuable business. Although female entrepreneurs have been shown to create more valuable businesses when they run startups or when there are overrepresentation of women on the board. Even when confronted with this data, the industry still fails to change. People say, okay, I know we're doing it wrong, but my gut instinct is better than anybody else's. And so they don't change. So we can't live with our gut instinct, but we also can't live without it. So what do we do? So the intuition researchers I spoke to told me that the most important thing to do comes down to this: trust but verify your intuition. What does that really mean? It means that intuitive insights need to be at the front of the line of our consideration when coming up with a new business model, when coming up with a new product or invention, when deciding what to invest in. We still need to rely on our gut instinct. But we need to look at that instinct and understand where it's really coming from, which can be hard. So companies that gather the most insights from intuition but keep cultural bias out tend to openly discuss and value intuitive ideas. I spent time with Ed Catmull from Pixar, and he told me the most important thing to do is when new ideas are being generated, that we shouldn't ask them to be justified by any amount of data or any amount of stories of what other companies are doing. We know Pixar creates wildly inventive things, not based on other people's models, but based on the intuition of a bunch of people within the company who are not being asked why. They're just being asked to explain what they care most about and what they most feel and ask their brain trust to do the same. But when we have an intuitive insight, we must test it. We must pat it down for biases. We need to ask ourselves, do I love this idea because of somebody else did it recently and it seemed to work? Do I love this idea because everyone around me is telling me that this is how it's done? Do I love this idea because it came from someone who looks like me and talks like me, and so I trust them? If we can do that, and we're in good environments where we're actually learning from our investments, our intuition can be scrubbed from this bias. And we can educate our intuition. So what a lot of leaders do who are running intuition-based organizations is they recognize that intuition works really well in environments where you get lots of fast feedback and where you're actually honest about when your intuition was right and when it was wrong. But if you're getting very long cycles of feedback and it's ambiguous, we can't really trust our intuition nearly as well. This is why Silicon Valley intuition can be so deadly and make such mistakes. So are you creating a learning culture where you're capturing intuitive insights, you're working off of them, but you're testing them, just like those folks at GiveDirectly who had this idea that some cultural intuition could be wrong, but first did a pilot test to prove that that was the case. And then finally, so much of the gold for innovation comes from being willing to find and consider ideas that seem counterintuitive to most. What does this mean? Well, just like Helena Folks saw that there was a cultural intuition within her company that cigarette sales would always be the case, or the GiveDirectly folks saw that there was a cultural intuition that you need to teach a man a fish, or people who founded Rideshare found that there was a cultural intuition that nobody would ever get into the car of a stranger, we need to consider ideas that other people think are crazy by questioning some of those core beliefs that somehow we see there might be a way around. So bring up some of, in your industry, what are the most common held beliefs? Could they possibly be wrong? And how can we test? Because once we do, counterintuitive ideas come out that can shake up entire industries. Okay. So, fourth trap and killer is a reliance on rules. I talked a little bit about this in my story, which was that as my company scaled and grew, I wanted to keep it creative, but that meant also making it predictable. When researchers asked teachers whether how important teaching creativity to students was, teachers ranked it as their number one most important tool and most important responsibility. But then when asked, who are your favorite students? Teachers almost universally said their least favorite students were their most creative one, and their most favorite students were their least creative ones. So we have this really difficult, ambivalent relationship with creativity. We want to get it out of ourselves. We want to get it out of our company and the people who follow us, but also we kind of hate it. And this goes from elementary school all the way up, obviously, into our adult working lives. Why is that? Why are we ambivalent about creativity? Well, creativity is so often based on disruption. When we follow rules to a T and get predictable, we rarely create anything new. But organizations need predictability in order to hold together. So how do we treat people who break rules within our organizations? Do we rely on strict discipline, or is it kind of a benign tolerance? Do we look the other way when people break the rules? And what's the right approach? Well, organizations that take the most out of unsafe thinking, I found, really don't do either of these. They recognize that rule breaking is something that actually leads to organizational improvement, and that rule breaking should be practiced and taught. Not just practiced, but actually repeatedly practiced and shown. So how does rule breaking create a breakthrough? This is Paul Buchheit. So he is a programmer. He was a programmer at Google in 2004, and he was working on this Skunkworks project called Caribou. Now, he had this brilliant idea that people should be given 1 gigabyte of storage with their email, while Hotmail at the time was giving about 10 megabytes. This was going to be enormously expensive, and he had really no idea how it could pay for himself. So he brought it to his boss, Marissa Mayer, and said to her, let's try to get this program to read people's emails and get them to give them ads that are based on what the email is about. Now, Mayer thought this was kind of crazy, and in fact, she thought it was immoral. This was ironic because Paul Buchheit is the guy who came up with Google's motto, don't be evil. She said to him, Paul, this is going to ruin us. I forbid you from creating this product. And Paul said, okay, I won't create the product, I promise. She looked him in the eyes and she said, are you sure? And he said, I'm sure. And that night he went home and he built the product. And he prototyped it on Mayer's email and on a couple of other bosses' emails. So when they came in the morning, Mayer saw an email, an ad for Al Gore's talk tagged to an email from a friend about climate change. Someone else was inviting her to go out and hike in the woods, and she got an ad for boots. She thought this was kind of amazing. And Larry Page and Sergey Brin saw it. They thought it was kind of amazing too. So they gave the chance to slowly roll this idea out to just a few hundred people. And suddenly, people were clamoring for invites to this new product. When Gmail launched, it was universally condemned by the experts. Lawmakers, business insiders told them that no one would want to have their emails read. It broke the basic laws of decency. But today there are over 1 billion happy Gmail users. And it's redefined the ideas of what's right and what's wrong. it was only created because Paul Buchheit wouldn't listen to his boss about a direct promise he had made. So how do we cultivate intelligent rule-breaking in our companies without descending into chaos? Is there any way to do this? The answer is yes, we can. And there have been a lot of studies about how to do it well so that we can have ethical cultures that don't descend into creative wastelands, because that's the kind of the polarity we have to deal with. We need people to do things for the good of the company, but we also need to capture the workarounds that are working and make sure that too many opportunities aren't being lost. So what do we do? One of the huge problems that organizations face and that speaker after speaker has told organizations to do is to continue to hire for culture, right? Find people who fit your culture, who believe in your mission, who are going to make everyone in your organization feel good. This leads to cultures where everyone thinks the same. And studies show that cognitive diversity, different life experience, different moralities, different values lead to much higher creativity, even when a homogenous team is all a group of highly achieving experts and a diverse team is a group of beginners. The diverse team will often outperform on creative tests. We build cultures when we hire for cultural fit that have a strict sense of what's right and wrong. And that strict sense of right and wrong eventually constricts the possibilities of the organization and what can happen. There's this concept called intelligent disobedience, which I found fascinating. Guide dogs can be taught to absolutely obey their masters in everything that they do. But then, if their masters, who are often blind, ask them to step out into the street and a truck is coming, the guide dog will refuse. They'll say no. The guide dog is still completely committed to the team it's on, but it knows how to disobey orders that it knows are wrong for the performance of the team. How do you teach intelligent disobedience? Well, it turns out that rule breaking is not corrosive to organizations when it's done out in the open. When leaders tell people that if there's a rule that's not working, and you feel that you need to break it, do so above the surface. People who break rules in organizations out in the open are actually judged as more trustworthy by their peers than people who are secretly breaking rules or than by people who follow all the rules. So how do we do it? Organizations are now role-playing disobedience. Managers need to actually not just talk about this, but reinforce it every day, or not every day, but reinforce it from time to time by bringing people in, giving them orders, and then teaching them how to go off a brief or how to say no to those orders and find another way around. We waste a tremendous amount of time and energy in our companies skirting rules and then pretending that we don't see people are skirting rules when we could be capturing the better way that these rule breakers are finding. There's a concept called positive deviance in public health. Positive deviance says that the best way to scale up public health is to find those people who are doing things really differently, but it's working, and then tell their stories to the larger group. So in many places where there's malnutrition and starvation, there's one family who's doing quite well. And maybe they're adding some local plant to their diet to round out the nutritional value of what everybody's eating. You need to talk to those people, find out how they're breaking from traditional norms, and then tell their story to everybody else. Sometimes within organizations, we do tolerate rule breaking, but how often do we reward it? How often do we share those stories? And finally, we need to minimize the number of rules that we want. So many people in organizations spend their time dodging a certain number of rules habitually, which means that other important rules lose their importance. We're no longer respectful of rules. I've talked to a few leaders who went to their written and unwritten rule books from their companies and reduced them by 50 to 75%. In doing so, the few remaining rules became things that people knew they had to follow, while all the energy wasted working around the massive employee handbooks was freed up for more creativity within the company. So think about, are you tolerating your rule breakers or are you celebrating them? And the last lesson that I learned that was a huge safe thinking trap and was one of mine as well is building cultures of niceness. I've always valued being nice, always wanted to be nice. But there's a really deep problem with cultures that value niceness. Here's how it works. Imagine 8 people come into a room. They all share a bunch of information about the challenge that they face as an organization, right? They have heard the boss talk 100 times about this set of information. They've all read the same journals about where their industry is going. But maybe 2 people in the room have some key special information that nobody else has, right? They know something about the moves of a competitor or a new emerging technology. You would think that the whole point of getting into that room would be to make sure that now everybody holds all the important information. Otherwise, we don't need to meet. We can just sort of work on our own. The problem is that in organizations that value niceness, that information will never come to the fore. It will be hidden. And this is especially dangerous, not just for the performance of the organization, but for the careers of women and minorities working within that organization. I'm going to tell you why, because it's pretty counterintuitive. In many ways, we build these nice cultures in order to be more welcoming to people who are different, when in fact, it vastly stunts their careers. So here's how it works. When organizations value harmony, the best way to build harmony is for the leader to speak, and then for everyone to share information similar to what the leader has just said. This happens on a subconscious level. It's called shared information bias. It's not just that we're kissing up to the leader, it's that we're actually forgetting what we thought once we hear what the group thinks. Shared information bias makes people feel good by hearing their own words repeated by other people. And before long, an entire group will go in one set of information, spend 2 hours in a meeting, and come out with the exact set of information more deeply enforced. Because they're more focused on building group harmony than they are on learning and growth. Now, most oftentimes, people outside of centers of power in an organization are going to hold that unusual information. And in the workplaces that we have, that is most often non-white people and women. On top of that, we have all these cultural biases that teach women to be nice. And that, again, creates this lockdown of unusual information from the edges that are actually the fuel for creativity. So when we create these workplaces that are based on harmony and niceness and kindness, we're losing that ability to shake up our beliefs. And then we go back to that idea of like Blockbuster walking out of meeting after meeting with the same idea. It comes from being caring more about the group feeling well than about seeing reality as it is. So we need to overthrow our niceness cultures and replace them with cultures of respect. How can we do that? Leaders need to speak last in meetings because shared information bias is primed when people with high status share their ideas. People literally forget. There's an amnesia that comes over the group, and the idea of agreeing with the leader becomes the most important thing that can happen. I saw a lot of amazing stuff about gamifying disagreement. If it's too hard for people to actually mix it up with each other and fight it out over ideas, make games out of it. The military uses red teams, for instance, which means that a chosen strategy will be given and another team will be given the opportunity to break that strategy down, to destroy it in every way possible, while still respecting their superiors because it's still a game. And finally, it's important to incentivize disruption and not just incentivize results. In organizations where getting results is the most important and most valued characteristic of a team or motivation of a team, we tend to, again, conglomerate around the safest choices. But when we give people rewards for breaking up consensus and breaking up agreeableness, it becomes a cultural norm, and people don't have to feel that they're tearing each other down when they fight out over ideas. Organizations where people are fighting but still respecting each other are generators of the greatest creativity. So I know I shared a bunch of ideas today, and I want to kind of leave you with the five most important ones that I think people should walk away with so that you can go more from this to someone like Helena Folks. The first is to reframe fear as creative fuel. Be an explorer, not an expert. Trust but verify your gut. Cultivate rule breaking and replace niceness with respect. Five simple things that are not at all simple to implement at the deepest levels, but I know have enormously changed my ability to create and taken me from an old style leader into someone who's far more flexible, far less afraid of change, and actually excited to embrace and thrive on change. But I think I can boil this down even further with one more story. So in 2012, a survey went out on Facebook. I know surveys on Facebook now have a different connotation, but a survey went out on Facebook asking people, how important is it to you to vote in an upcoming election? And people would respond to the survey, and those who said it was important to them, their likelihood to vote went from 50% to 70%. This is a pretty good intervention. But they also sent out a slightly different survey. It said, how important is it to you to be a voter in this upcoming election? And for those people, 90% actually went out and voted. That means of the laggards, half of them overcame their inertia simply by changing that one set of words from how important is it to you to vote to how important it is for you to be a voter. Why does it change? Well, a quirk of human psychology is that we create images of ourselves, identities. And then everything that we do, in many ways, is done to live up to that identity, to create a story about ourselves, and then to live out that story. And that makes us do difficult things. It makes us break with convention and makes us push ourselves into situations that might scare us. And so for me, perhaps, I don't walk around with all this science in my head and all these stories, but for me, this ideal of being an unsafe thinker, of asking myself, what would an unsafe thinker do in this situation? Answering that question and then doing it has been the breakthrough for me.